Hello, ladies and gents, and welcome to episode 15 of the Homesteading UK podcast, season 2, episode 15. I'm Alan, I'm here with my mate Mike. How you doing, Mike?
Hurdy-gritty.
Mate, that's a bit of a mouthful, that first bit, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's all numbers and letters.
Yeah, I know, mate.
I'm glad you do that bit.
People like to know what they're listening to. So, we're getting on to episode 15 of the newly named, and we still haven't done
it. It's not new now, mate.
I know, but we still haven't done the outro properly yet, though. We're going to have to do that. I've got my guitar over there.
You do that.
We'll do that later on, perhaps.
I reckon you do. Get your dog barking in the background.
Oh, yeah, he's just chilling in the corner. He's knackered.
There's been some dog action on the podcast.
That's amazing, isn't it? I love that little pup, amazing, beautiful.
I'm going to have to post. Obviously, I've got a couple of working dogs.
Mate, there's no way Daisy's winning no beauty contests, that's for sure.
I think my two homestead dogs will be getting a feature soon.
Homestead hounds.
Homestead hounds, yeah. Let's get them on there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure mine will win.
So.
And they have got their uses, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, they have got their uses. Well, Daisy's quite a good draft excluder, so she lies down in front of the door, and if you just roll her over a little bit, she forms quite an effective draft-proofing system.
Okay, yeah.
And the amount of money I've had to save on doorbells with my other dog is...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because as soon as... It just howls, so...
Oh, well, there you go.
There you go, see?
Fulfilling their purpose on the
homestead.
Absolutely. Loving that.
Mind you, I can't ever get near the fire, so it's probably counterproductive.
I tell you what, it's mad, isn't it? My dog, he sits his head almost on the glass.
Yeah.
Just lays right by the front of it.
My dog loves it. When that fire's on, I can't get in the front room, am I, near the fire?
Right.
Well, I've got all the washing up on all the bottom. Everything. I haven't turned my tumble dryer on yet, so everything's drying on clothes horses. So it's been a bit... That's it, mate. It's lean times in the old roof house, mate. Lean times!
Well, it's not cold enough to need the centre heating on, that's for sure.
No.
Yeah, anyway. So,
anyway.
Yeah, so how you been doing, mate? You good?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's been... It's been a busy couple of weeks, but you know, I'm in the middle of the transition between the growing and the harvesting, and I'm now ticking over into what will probably be more of my winter work on the farm, which is certainly timber harvesting and hopefully some timber milling and things like that. So I'm really looking forward to that, actually, and it's something that, you know, I'm really keen to learn and develop those skills, as you know, with the qualification and everything like that that I'm still studying for. And I'm going to go and do my chainsaw tickets, hopefully, at the beginning of December. So, you know, it's not just about learning things and having that practical kind of aspect. But I suppose if you can, in whatever you're doing, pick up some qualifications. You know, I'm from an education background, but if you can pick up some qualifications, it might lead to something down the line.
Hmm.
And then, you know, if you wanted to go and do a day's work with another company or someone like that, and you've got some practical tickets or some actual, you know, physical qualifications, it makes a bit of a difference sometimes, actually.
Yeah.
You know, something as simple as, you know, in education, we had to do our basic food hygiene and food prep. Do you remember? I've used that all the time.
You never have to do that once, don't you, as well, I think?
Yeah.
Once you've done it,
and
it's
first
done.
Aid and all of those things, qualifications you can pick up. They come in very handy. I'm hoping the first aid, I don't ever need that when I'm timber milling, but you never know.
Yeah. Hopefully not, eh? Might need more than first aid if you're in that situation, mate. What comes after first aid? Second aid?
Nah.
No?
Nah. I don't know. Primary care. Once you get primary care, secondary care.
A&E.
We don't even talk about that.
Yeah.
Don't attempt fate.
No,
there we go.
Quite, yeah.
But yeah, so there has been, obviously, still plantings going on.
Yep.
My autumn plants, we will come to some of those things in a minute, but I've still got one polytunnel up. The second polytunnel is in process, but it has been, I mean, the weather over the last fortnight in the UK is, do you know what? I was going to say it's been really bad, but it isn't really. It's been like that for the last few years this time of the year.
Yeah.
We are starting to see way more localised flooding.
Hmm.
And after what was the driest year on record, we're now into the wet season.
Well, yeah.
And it seems to be that we have got a pattern now of, you know, continuous quite heavy rain. And on the back of the dry season, I don't know. I mean, I'm not that au fait with it. Whether the water is still struggling to permeate the ground, I can't imagine it is now. But certainly when we first started to get rain, it was just hitting the hard ground. And it wasn't really rivers bursting their banks. It was surface flooding, I think they call it, surface water flooding.
Yeah.
And certainly where I'm working now, luckily the farm's on a hill, but the heavy clay, the combination of the heavy clay and the real heavy downpours have made outside work actually quite untenable on that on the ground. Yeah. So I can't even lift my carrots at the moment.
It's gonna ruin your soil structure on your
stocks. No, mate, I'll just sink. I can't get in there. And if I tried to drive a tractor on it, I would just get bogged down. It'd be up to the axles. No, well, it's so soft.
I can tell you the rivers are flooded because I drove through flood water to get here tonight.
I had Alfred Stemmer's bad.
So where I've driven through, it's not impassable yet, but if it rains too much more, it will be.
And I think that's something that we have got to all, you know, there's a danger, isn't there, that sometimes our podcasts might kind of year on year become, you know, saying the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
But even in the time that we've been doing this in 18 months, you know, you could say, you know, with some hindsight, we can see changes even in, you know, and they might be just seasonal or yearly, but I'm noticing a downward trend in the amount of rainfall in the summer and the temperature hike now. Yeah. I mean, the temperatures in November this year are unbelievable.
Well, you saw that post I put on the Facebook group. Yeah. That is mad. I mean, and it's only 10 days ago that I was walking in the morning, and I take the dog out for first thing in the morning every morning, and I'm out in the field by 6:30, and it's 17 degrees Celsius. Mm. Now that is, I mean, that could easily be an August afternoon in where I live, right? Yeah. Certain, you know, depending on the weather front that's coming in. And I've been walking out there, like, start out in my coat. Mm. By the time I get back, I'm just in my t-shirt, and it's 6:30 in the morning in late October. Mm. It's absolutely mad, and it's barely been in single figures where I live yet.
No, I don't think it has.
Two nights, I think, towards the end of October, where it dropped down into reasonably in single figures, but that's it.
And so what that's aided, certainly in the polytunnel, which I've, you know, and I knew it would happen, is that what I'm starting to get now is that soft, stagnant air in the tunnel. And so the ventilation is really, really important now. Mm-hmm. More so even than in the summer, because what I'm getting now is dampening off, really, in effect.
Yeah.
And I've been very careful about my planting distances in the tunnel.
Okay.
But I think even that, I'm learning and having to widen the gaps between things. So, for people who are planting out still, and you know, not sowing, there's only a couple of things to sow. But if you're planting things that you've raised in modules or pots out, watering now becomes it's really strategic. You know, I think that knowing what you don't want is wet ground, loads of wet ground. Yeah. You need to be really mindful that, whereas if you overwatered, you could get away with it in the summer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you can't, and it's going to sit there.
Indoor
I'm talking about indoor. Yeah. Well, you don't need to water outdoors at the moment, mate. Unless you're growing rice. You're growing rice?
Not yet.
I could grow some mean rice in that field at the moment.
Yeah.
I've read all about it. I've got a great book on small grain raising, by the way.
Yeah.
I can't remember it's by, but I would definitely recommend it. I'll take a photo of it and put it up.
Yeah.
I've learned loads out of it. It's an American novel. It's an American text. But everything I've done so far has come from that. And obviously meeting with Andrew, the farmer, who gave me loads of advice and came over and visited the site. But the winter wheat's all right. It's up.
Yeah.
It looks quite tough, and I have to say. But how that will be affected by this rain, I don't know.
I should be all right. It's used to this. It's meant for the winter, isn't it? And it rains in the winter, so it could do with it being colder, perhaps, if anything.
There's someone actually commenting on the Facebook, look.
That's Facebook like comments.
This is live.
Mark, you're getting a mention. You just put a Facebook post up.
I hope it wasn't rude. We won't read it out in case. I've been just doing that prep for the woodworking, really. And when I say woodworking, I'm not talking about making furniture. I'm talking about harvesting and felling trees, cutting firewood for next year.
Yep.
And also, we've got a timber mill at the farm, which I've been putting together and learning how to do that and getting all that up and running and all the safety stuff that comes with it, but also then looking at what products we might want to develop.
Yep.
And the idea, really, with the timber milling is that we want to be self-sufficient for timber on site. So, you know, chestnut posts and rails and fence posts and gate posts and things like that.
Yeah.
But it could go beyond that. You know, it could go into some feather edging and some cladding. It certainly could go into chestnut wainy edge boards if we wanted to build some cow sheds or some structures, you know. And then once that kind of level of self-sufficiency is reached through the chestnut that's on site, that's what it's for, really.
Yeah.
There are other trees which and other pieces of woodland which need managing, and there could be some quite nice one-off pieces of timbers coming out of there for selling for artisan products. So, you know, obviously it'll have to be in stick and drying out for a couple of years. But if we mill those oak or yew, or not yew, probably I haven't got many yew, but if we were milling some really nice lime, or if we were milling some really nice elm, or if we were milling some really nice alder, and all these different types of woods we've got on site, cherry and what have you, you know, we could look at that as a source of income for people who might want a nice tabletop or a nice floating mantelpiece or a beam for a certain room or something like that. And so that is just another income stream which we'd like to explore. But for me, you know, the chainsaw tickets and learning how to sawmill and develop some forestry skills, that's very much something I've always wanted to do. And that's run through me for a long time, you know, probably from when I was a kid, growing up in Epping Forest, really. But it has, you know, and I just feel really lucky to get a chance to have to do some of these things, you know. So that's where I'm at with regards to that. And then inside the tunnel, I'm clearing tomatoes now. Mm-hmm. You know, they're coming out. I'm clearing courgettes, so I've still got a few courgette plants inside. They were the late ones that I put in. And I'm only getting baby courgettes off them, but they're all right. Yep. Still getting five or six a week or something like that. But they've finished now, really. And then I've got the whole tunnel nearly is going to be given over to brassicas, really, to see me through. But what's exciting now is that I'm thinking that even if they're out, you know, we've got a lot of carrots in, and I've got some carrots preserved already, just frozen, probably be all right. Probably be okay, because I know that in January I can sow carrots probably.
Inside you can, yeah.
I probably could. And then, you know, maybe by the end of March, I could be thinning and having the baby ones. And so I think that we could be in a position where we have got that level of self-sufficiency going right through. I think that what I'm noticing is that it would be nice if I had a slight more variance. So I'm looking around for some sweet potatoes or even some Jerusalem artichokes or other things which just around now, because we've had carrots all year and we've had beans and we had courgettes and we had tomatoes and all of those things. And I would say that we've got all of those things pretty, you know, I don't think that they're going to run out. Let's put it that way, between the stuff that's left in the freezer. But it would be nice, I think, to not think that all I've got is cabbage, basically, or kale, or green leaf from now until March. And so for that reason, I did do some Clotonia, which is a miner's lettuce leaf. I've got some overwintering rocket and coriander. So there is an option there for a quite nice salad. The lettuces will probably go through. I've looked at them and I got them at the right stage, though, because you don't want too much on top, because they will rot off. So they're looking all right. And the chilies are still flowering and giving. I mean, they're not going to keep going, but they're unbelievable. And there's still beetroot in the ground, which is swelling slowly now.
If you've got the right varieties, they should have winter all right. And then,
I've got others to jump on next year to go forward. I'm talking about ones which are probably the size of a golf ball, tennis ball. So, but we're eating them and then they're not coming out. And then, of course, there's squash and pumpkin there and loads of onions and so on and so forth. The cauliflowers have... I've got about four left. They've been really successful. I couldn't believe they grew as well as they have. And if I'd have had more space, I think I would have done a second batch. I have got another batch, but when I sowed them, they're not really due until kind of maybe April. They kick on again themselves in the new year. But I would have liked to have had another batch following this for sort of November, December, January. So I kind of missed the sowing there. But the cabbages that I've planted, those January kings, we've actually eaten those. They were like a deep red veined one. And I had one lot that I had to dig out because of aphid damage, if you remember the Savoy. So I lost probably 20 cabbages there because they were just harbouring pests. So I got them out. And I knew I was going to have a gap, but I probably won't, because the Wheeler's Imperial and the Greyhound are eatable now as spring greens. And I've done loads of them. Millions of them.
They're coming well then, in that case.
There's about 80 or 90, 80. Probably. It's probably about 80 altogether, 90 of those. But what's really nice is that I'm getting two crops off all the cauliflower at the moment.
Okay. So you're taking the head and then you're letting the side shoots.
No, there's loads of leaf.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay.
There's loads of leaf.
Right.
Not like, you know, when you buy a cauliflower and it's got three or four of those little flat. I mean, this has got like a cabbage around the outside. Right, okay. So, and I have to say, my kids are loving it.
Oh, the cabbage is delicious.
It's delicious, yeah.
Really good.
So we're eating the green.
Well underrated.
We're eating the green and the white parts of the vegetable as one. So we've got that. And then, of course, the kale's still going strong. The chard is still going strong.
Yeah.
But it's all green leaf, you know?
Yeah.
And so as long as I've got some carrots in store, I'll be okay. And there's still lots frozen, but... And the leeks, obviously, we're working our way through. But there is definitely a seasonality to it coming. And funny enough, I don't want any tomatoes at the moment. Or cucumbers, no.
Funny, isn't it?
Well, it's odd, isn't it? Because we got to the stage where we ate all of the fresh.
Yeah.
I'm just taking them down there. Cucumbers have been gone for probably about a month. And, you know, bought a cucumber from the shop, bought some tomatoes from the shop.
Don't taste the same.
It's not just about the taste. It's because that's what I've eaten loads of over the summer.
Yeah.
I don't actually want them now. I want the Swedes.
Okay. Yeah,
you know, right. Swedes have done really well, by the way.
I've got a lovely Swede in the
ground. There you go.
I've got one that's balled up really nice for once. So they always do that for me. So it's really nice to see.
Well, they got absolutely battered outside by cabbage white. All the top growth got eaten.
Yeah.
But they have swelled up beautifully. I have to say the rain's done them a favour. Some of them have even split.
Right.
But they're all right. And and I didn't do too many of those, but they've done okay. Mm. And some of the parsnips that I grew inside in the most stoniest, horriblest ground going. They look all right. I think there'll be a Christmas dinner there anyway.
Oh, nice.
So it's all primed and ready to just upscale now next year.
Yeah.
But there's still plenty coming out. And there is some good variety there. But I think, like I was just saying there at the beginning, a few little extras that if I could weave in a few extras next year, I think it would just bring a bit of variation.
But if we'd have been having this conversation this time last year, as we did actually probably, but I don't think we recorded any of it at this point, you'd have been saying to me, this year's a year of learning.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be an opportunity to, you know, hopefully get some plenty of vegetables out and maybe be self-sufficient for the summer. Mm. But then there's going to be a lot of learning to be done and I've got to try and figure it out, you know, what I need and where. And obviously the polytunnel is a bit of a game changer.
Yeah, massive.
In quite a big way. And so you'd have been saying, well, I've got to figure out how that works. Mm. And so what you're saying really is that what we'd have anticipated happening is happening.
Mm.
Yeah, and so you're going to learn a bit. Next year you'll do things slightly differently, as we all do anyway.
Absolutely.
I think
the potatoes will just about see us through.
Yeah.
I think there'll be enough there. And they seem to be doing all right in the storage that we've got them in.
Yeah.
They seem to be doing pretty well and... on the Desiree main crop now, which are a good keeper. So.
They're really good, yeah.
They're lovely spuds as well. Make great chips, I have to say.
Well, I popped into the allotment today for the first time in probably 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to go the last couple of weekends. I've been so busy. Other things going on, mostly family stuff. And I'm in a reasonably similar position. Obviously, mine's all outdoors. So the beans and everything are done. Tomatoes, I've actually still got tomatoes on the vine outdoors.
Mm.
They're not ripening now, but they are... going from that kind of opaque colour to the shiny one. So if I bring them in, they now will be all right. There's a few signs of blight, though, now starting to come. And I lost my Christmas buds to blight.
Mm.
But purple sprout and broccoli is already starting to produce.
Oh, is it? Yeah, because my second lot in the tunnel is big and ready now.
Yeah.
But I don't think it will come until... I don't think mine's going to come until the spring.
Well, mine shouldn't, because mine is the plants you gave me.
Mm. Oh, yeah,
mostly. I think I did one sowing.
And mine are indoors and yours are outdoors.
Yeah, so I've got the main heads on some of them are already ready to eat. Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Only a couple, but there's a couple that have obviously, you know, bolted or whatever, I don't know, but they're absolutely lovely. And actually, my green sprouting, which I thought had failed miserably in the summer with all the heat, I never got around to taking it out, is now producing quite nicely.
Oh, wow, that's crazy. It just goes to show.
Yeah, so... for the sake of not being quick to tidy up, I've actually got a crop of green sprout.
Well. I've got sprouts as well. But they've come early because they're in the tunnel.
Yeah. So next year, a lot of that will be outside and you won't have the same problem.
I don't think any of it will be outside, but it'll be in a tunnel which has
it's
just got mesh sides,
Probably quite so warm.
I definitely won't be going outside, will you? No. Everything will just get eaten.
It'll be covered, yeah. So what else have I got? So I've got loads of leeks. I've got what you need to get into is American landcress.
Mm. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, so I've got some of that and it is absolutely fantastic.
Mm.
So tasty.
Yeah, it's quite fiery though, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that though. But a little bit of that in a salad, a bit like your rocket can be. Rocket can be fiery, radish can be fiery.
Yeah.
Makes the salad a bit more interesting.
I've got to tell you.
Go on.
Pak choy, bro.
Yeah.
Never been able to grow it.
Right, everything eats it.
Yeah.
Right.
I've got two rows of nice pak choy.
Yeah.
And a row of mooli.
Indoors?
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, it's not pest pressure in there yet.
I reckon
it?
I'll get one good stir fry out
Mate,
of it.
Mate, I'm going to come over and bring you some slugs and snails and just pop
there
them in.
There are slugs in the tunnel now.
Good.
Yeah. No, not good. There are slugs in the tunnel now, yeah. But doesn't seem to be too bad. Doesn't seem to be too bad. Yeah. It isn't wet in there, you see. That's the other thing you've got to remember. Yeah. Is that obviously, we control the moisture, and slugs don't tend to like the dry soil, do they?
Wet,
and but when I go over a lot of the beds with cultivator, I think I will be able to look quite closely at what's in there. You know what I mean? One of the things that I've decided to do is that I'm taking these tomatoes out, and probably the last fifth of the tunnel I put down on muck, if you remember, and I planted all the tomatoes in it. I was going to clear all of that muck out and dress that over the other beds. Mm. I'm actually going to plant all my spring cabbages in it straight on top because I know there's plenty of nutrient left in there because the tomatoes were so wide apart.
Well, they also won't have used all the nitrogen, which is what the greens
chance.
Want. So you're
so laughing. And I thought, well, and then after that, it'll be quite spent. So, but it will mean that in the spring, I will have almost a blank canvas again because a lot of those crops will be out, you know, and then I'll just redo it and probably dig out, move a lot of that soil up so that I'm not putting tomatoes back in the same soil.
Yeah.
But what I bring out, which will be pretty well rotted, well, very well rotted, I'll use it to top dress all the other beds, I think, and just backfill the other end. But hopefully I'll have a whole other tunnel by then as well.
That'd be handy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it will be amazing.
So for me, I've moved indoors a bit.
Mm.
I've been doing a lot of preserving again, back into that. My tomatoes that I took off, you saw those big baskets.
Yeah.
I took 5 kilos of ripe tomatoes off the other day out of those baskets. Still a few green ones in there. I don't know if I'm going to last till December. I think they might all be ripe by then.
Reckon.
It's going to be close. So normally
I'll give you a few if you like.
Yeah. You know me, I use them.
Yeah.
And I've obviously been back on the cheese making, which has been really nice.
Yeah, I saw that.
So I've done.
A bit of cheese making myself.
Have you? What'd you do?
Labneh.
Yeah, but still.
Tell you what, mate.
It's great, isn't it?
Absolutely
so
brilliant.
If you've never tried it, get some live yogurt and a cheesecloth. Make sure you sterilise your cheesecloth. You can do that just by boiling it really hard for 10 minutes.
Oops.
No, you don't need to. You get 5 days out of it probably anyway. But sterilise your cheesecloth just in case. 10 minutes in boiling water. Take it out, let it cool. And then you're going to get your live yogurt and literally pour it into the cheesecloth and hang it up for 24 hours. And when it's finished, that's it. You put a little bit of salt in it, and then hang it up for 24 hours. And then when it's finished, you'll get a load of whey come out, so you need to put a bowl underneath to catch all the liquid that comes out. What you'll get is a really thick, creamy yogurt, which is a bit like a cheese, I suppose, similar kind of like to maybe mascarpone, perhaps, in consistency, texture.
Well, I had what I had. So I had a big pot of zero-fat Tesco Greek yogurt,
right,
which is going out of date.
Yeah.
Not like within days, but within a week.
Yeah.
So I put it in an unsterilised tea towel.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that'll do.
Right.
Yeah.
In a sieve.
Yeah.
Over a bowl.
Yeah. That's
in
it.
The fridge.
Okay, that'll do it.
And I'll tell you what, mate. I thought it was going to have a lot of moisture come out, but it didn't.
Okay.
But what was noticeable was the change. Because I left it in there a long time.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, probably 10 days.
All right. Okay.
Right. So it was in there for 4 or 5 days. And then I could take it out of the sieve.
Yeah.
And if I'm honest with you, mine looked more like a mozzarella.
Okay.
You know, like a solid. Yeah. I could have picked it up.
Yeah.
And I just left it, but it's still very creamy.
Yeah.
But my kids loved it. Yeah. And I only ate that yesterday.
It's genius, isn't it?
And we had it with crab apple jelly on crackers.
Oh, yes.
And it was
winner.
Proper good.
Yeah, winner.
But it would have made, and still will, mate, there's still some left.
Yeah.
It would have made great kind of dips. You know, mixed, have herbs mixed through it, have it with maybe some homemade flatbreads. It would have been like that kind of a
mezze.
What do you call it?
Yeah, it's mezze. It's Middle Eastern mezze. Mm. So you'd have it. So you typically have that with like nuts and honey and stuff like that. Yeah.
But it's not salty.
No.
So.
Because it's not cheese.
No, but I reckon you could make a cheesecake out of it.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's what I'm thinking of doing. So last year when I made my Christmas cheesecake with the goat's milk, I had problems making, because you can make the ricotta, that's really easy, But making a mascarpone type...
I was going to say, but you can make...
Cheese with goat's milk is difficult, because mascarpone is made with cream.
Yeah.
High content of cream.
Yeah.
So I can't recreate that, because goat's milk hasn't got high fat content, high cream content. So I'm thinking that potentially swapping that in, maybe even making some live yogurt with goat's milk.
And then seeing if
then
you can turn it into
and
a
see if I can turn it into like a goat's milk lab and see what happens.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
It'd be interesting to see what that comes out like.
I reckon it'd make a banging banoffee pie.
Make a banging banoffee pie. I was thinking about what it compares to, and I don't buy like cream cheese spreads like Dairy Leaf.
Oh, no, it's like Philadelphia.
Like Philadelphia.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Right, okay. But I would imagine that Philadelphia, though, again, cream cheese, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I would have... But if you could take it either way, you could either sweeten it and then take it down a, you know, really simple dessert route, or you could take it with salt and pepper and cracked black pepper or herbs chilies running through it and all of that. I've got an idea here. Cool. I reckon this is what I might try if I make it again. Get some ramekins. I reckon layers of labneh, granola, jam, and then chilled. Would be a
cheesecake dessert in the fridge.
I tell you what, I reckon that could be.
I reckon if you might need to put a bit of icing sugar into the labneh, just to sweeten it up.
We've got a jam in it, mate. And the granola or honey.
Oh, yeah, actually, put honey in it.
Yeah, that would be great.
That'd do it.
Crushed, I mean, I don't eat them, but I could see pistachios going on in there.
Pistachios.
And then your labneh and then your honey layered like that in a wine glass. So you could see all the layers.
A bit 1980s.
A bit 1980s with a nice little, with a nice long spoon. Just
I like
after.
That.
All right, it could be good.
Yeah, I'm going to have a go at that.
Yeah.
Christmas
or,
is coming.
Not being funny, mate, you just put a big dollop of it on top of an apple crumble and it'll melt down and it'll be absolutely baggy.
Just put a big dollop of it in a bowl, get some sourdough crackers and have at it, as far as I'm concerned. That sounds great.
So, for me, that was one of the first things I'd ever done like that.
All right.
And I would certainly do it again. I think that my next stage would be to, rather than buy the yoghurt, would be to make it in my slow cooker.
Yeah.
Because I've still yet to do that.
And I think if you're buying yoghurt to make that, it's probably not very cost effective.
No.
Whereas if with the yoghurt that I'm making, because I'm making best part of a litre and a half of yoghurt at a time, I'm making a load of that stuff every time I do it.
Yeah.
Or I could choose to make smaller batches. Mm. But it's really very cost effective at that point, because I think it's probably cost
effective. So it's strange yoghurt. That's what it is.
That's what it is, yeah.
Strange yoghurt, but it... Something does happen to it over time, I think, as well.
Well, it doesn't culture. I mean, because the other thing I've done with this is the kefir cheese, in the same way, right? So you get your milk kefir, and you strain that in the same way, and you get this kefir cheese, which is very, very similar, actually. We tried the two, didn't we?
We did,
taste test that time. And I think the kefir cheese has got a bit more culture to it, because it's cultured.
Yeah,
whereas the live yoghurt is cultured as well, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Will that yoghurt I had have been live yoghurt?
Oh, I don't know.
It probably wasn't.
Maybe it's not.
I don't think... It was just literally Tesco's zero-fat Greek yoghurt.
Right, okay. The cheap blue stripy stuff.
Green.
Green, okay.
Yeah, because it was zero-fat.
Right, okay.
It was delicious though, mate.
Yeah, yeah. That moment, if you like it, it doesn't matter, does it?
But it was absolutely lovely.
Yeah.
And it's... So, I mean, there's still some left, like I say, but...
I wonder if the flavour's different, though, then, from my live yoghurt, because that is cultured with
it's
the
quite,
yoghurt
It's cultures. Quite mild. It's not, no, it's not packed with punch, but it would... I know it sounds weird, but if you'd grate cheese into it and used it like that, and then onion, oh, man, that'd make a banging sandwich.
Yeah.
Sort of like cream cheese and onion. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got to tell you my faux pas, though, right? I'm going to talk to you about this. This is just make me laugh. I know that my brain is on the way out, right? So when you work like I am, like a lot of people are, lunch is very important.
Yes.
Very important. So when I sit down, even if I'm having a bog standard packed lunch, and I sit down at 1 o'clock, I make a cup of tea and a cup and salsa, I sit down in my workshop, and I sit down, and yesterday, mate, got my sandwiches out, opened them up. And what did I have in my sandwiches? I'd made them. I swear I made them. I had two pickle sandwiches. I just forgot to put the cheese in. I don't know where it went. I opened them both up, and all there was in there was pickle.
Branston, yeah.
Four slices, two rounds like that. I opened them both. I was like, "Where's the cheese at?" I must have lost the plot the night before.
Did you eat them?
Of course I did. Yeah. But I didn't have anything. Well, I had salad.
Yeah.
I could went and picked some salad from the tunnel, man. But it was like, oh man, I can't see how disappointed I was.
Oh, dear.
It was so bad, isn't it? So what I need was a little bit of labneh. I could have banged that in there. They've been perfect.
So I
can recommend a pickle sandwich for everyone out there.
Oh dear. So I've made a couple of those semi-hard cheeses, and I've really struggled with this time.
Mm.
Just keeping the mould off the outside has been a battle. a really big battle this time, and I found it really hard. And in fact, I got to one that I had three,
yeah.
And the third one I've ended up just chucking out because I wasn't happy with it. So I'm hoping that the two that I've managed to get through will be okay.
So am I right in thinking that the biggest problem is that you've got to use a fridge and it's too damp?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So could you put a silica pack in your cheese thing?
I suppose so. I hadn't thought of that.
Right. So when I had my wood mill delivered,
yeah.
There's two massive silica packs in it.
Yeah.
So I'll bring them in for you.
All right.
Because I kept them.
Oh,
so they're about this big.
Yeah.
They're whacking great big things.
All right.
Just as long as it wouldn't adversely affect the flavour. I can't see how it would because all they do is suck in moisture.
Mate, I've got to try something because at the moment...
Wrap the cheese in silica. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I'm considering is buying a vacuum sealer.
Okay, yeah.
To vacuum seal them and then just age them like that.
Yeah.
So it should solve the problem, right? There's no air in there.
I don't know if they need any air, do they?
Well, I think it slows down the maturation process, but I'm not worried about that.
No.
I'm not worried about the time. That's not a big factor for me. I'm just going to make a load and I'll keep doing it. And then it might take, I don't know, a year before I can start eating any. That's okay.
That's right, yeah.
I've got this battle where I'm just worried about wasting that money that I've talked about before, about how much it costs. So I've done that, and I've also now done some soft cheese.
Okay.
Like the ones I did last year with the white culture on the outside. Yeah. I've got five nice big fat ones of those that I did. So I'm looking forward to being able to get there in the moulds at the moment, draining.
Mm. Well, I have to say, with the Abner, that's something that I would do for Christmas.
Yeah.
And then I would freeze them. I'd make a load up
of
different flavours and garlic and herb and all of that. And that would still feel quite special getting them out even, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So I do think for people who are on... maybe you haven't got the inclination to go for the hard cheese or the equipment or the setup. Certainly doing those strange yogurt cheeses is a really good start.
Really good starting point.
And in fact, that might be all you ever do.
It might well be all you ever do. And in fact, there are many recipes for cheeses that are cultured with yogurt or kefir.
Right, okay.
So rather than buying specialised cultures and making culture starters and all some of the nonsense I got into... actually, what you can just do is use some of your yogurt or use some of your kefir if you're keeping that. So if you're thinking out there and you're thinking, oh, I'd like to have a go, I don't want to get into like spending loads of money to get started, that's a really good place to look.
Well, I know that I'll do that now.
Yeah.
And like I say, I would like to go one step back and make my own yogurt from milk before I make my own milk from a cow. But it would be nice to make some yogurt from milk and then take that right through.
I think that sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
One step back.
Yeah, go one step
Everything
back.
Everything is one step back.
Absolutely.
Like one step back closer to source.
Yeah.
And the next step then is to get the
coffee.
Milk.
I'm struggling with how. Get coffee in the polytunnel.
Well.
And then I've got to roast it though.
I'm thinking you need to grab me some lemons, and I know that's going to be controversial, but.
Oh, no, I like lemons, aren't I?
I think we need some lemons.
I think we'll be fighting over them though. I use them all the time,
I'm going to need some, I think.
So the other things that I prepared are the fire cider.
Yeah.
And I've been agitating that.
Yep.
That's looking good. And I believe that when we did this last time, we'd made bacon, but we hadn't eaten it.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think mine was a little bit further ahead than yours, and mine's lovely. But it doesn't look as nice as yours because you've sliced yours beautifully.
Thumped mine, man. Absolutely banging. Got a pack left, though.
Yeah.
And just got the recipe right.
Yeah.
So I will do one more.
What was the recipe you used this time?
So I used, let me just see if I can remember it off the bat. I think it was 60 grams of salt for a kilo of meat.
Right.
Does that sound about right? Yeah, about 60 grams of salt for a kilo of meat. I think that's right. I will write it down and post
it.
And then about 20 grams of sugar.
Okay.
And then...
sounds like a little, not very much to me, but...
No, I didn't want a very sweet... Well, I don't want a particularly sweet cure.
Either of them, of both. Not a lot of cure there.
All right.
For a kilo. But anyway.
But... what I did was I wrapped it.
Okay.
I didn't make a brine and just pack it on and leave it dripping out. I wrapped it.
Mm.
And there was also in mine a fifth of a teaspoon, so like a fifth of a gram or something, of saltpeter in mine.
Yeah.
And I think that really improves the colour and the cooking quality of what it becomes.
Okay.
It certainly stays pink when you cook it, you know, basically. But I wanted to try this wrapping technique because when I did it before, you know, and the blood drains out and it's sitting in the blood and then you pour the blood off and then am I pouring too much of the cure away? And then what, do I put more cure on? Do I have to make up more cure?
No, you don't, no.
No, you're not supposed to, are
just
you?
Just turn it, that's what you need to do.
Yeah. So for me, I wanted to, because I've also read that you can vac pack your bacon.
Yep.
And so it almost becomes counterproductive, doesn't it?
Right, it ends up being wet cure at that point, as far as I'm concerned. It's a bit like that when you go and buy a catering pack of bacon, and you open it up, there's always liquid in there.
Yeah.
And it's all the liquid that's come out because it's effectively been it's been dry cured, but it's not, because it's been cured in its own liquid.
Yeah, so what happened was, I wrapped it in cling film, and even though I wrapped it up in cling film really well, it still escaped, lots of it.
Yeah.
So most of it came out, and then I did that for about 2 days, and then there was still some left in it, but I had to turn it every day. And that's very important if you've got it in plastic, because what you don't want is the cure to sit on one side or the blood in effect,
isn't it? Yeah.
And so I did that for, and I actually cured mine for 10 days.
Okay.
It was in there for 10 days. I wanted to get it out over 7, but I was away or we were gigging or something happened. I think it was about 10 days. Or was it? No, sorry. It was 7 days.
And I only did mine for 5.
Time. And I was supposed to do mine for 5, but it ended up being 7. But it was fine.
Yeah.
Absolutely fine. But the thing that I did do is I got it out and I dried it for 3 days. That's the 10 days.
Okay, how did that? Because that's what we spoke about last time. How did the drying go?
Great. Yeah. Absolutely great. So for the first day, I actually just left it in the cupboard.
Yeah.
I just got it out and left it out. If I'd have had somewhere nice and airy and cool to hang it, but my worry was that it was really damp in the atmosphere, so I just left it in a cupboard in the kitchen for the first day to form that, I think it's called a pellicle.
That's it, what you were saying before.
And it dried on the outside, and then I left it for 2 more days. And what that actually meant, I think, was that it was a lot easier to slice.
Okay.
Because it wasn't wet.
Yeah.
It was nice and dry.
Okay.
And so,
did you not freeze it before you sliced it?
Just sliced it fresh. Okay. And I sliced it, and out of the kilo that I had, I got 36 slices.
Wow. Okay.
And that's the thing about using the slicer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've got that even
slice. That's the problem I'm having with cutting it, and I've bashed my hand up.
Alan gets 2 slices.
I can't even have my knife properly at the minute. I've smashed my hand up. So, So actually getting a decent slice out of mine with my knife and my hand, I can't even gimpy hand cut off the knife, it's a nightmare. So actually slicing it up gives you...
Yeah.
And that, at that point, a kilo for 36 slices, what did you pay for the kilo? 10 quid?
£9.50 or £9.60. So it works out about £10 a kilo, right? Which is what dry cured bacon is, or was, 2 years ago in my farm shop.
Right.
But I expect it's more than that now.
I bet it is, yeah. Yeah, so you're getting a better product, potentially, certainly cheaper.
Not cheap, not as cheap as the 175 pack I can get in Tesco's for 360 grams.
So how thick are you cutting your bacon?
Pretty thick.
Okay.
Yeah. And you could go thinner.
Yeah.
But then what you're going to lose is what I want it for.
Yeah.
You know, I want to have 2 slices.
In a nice meaty sandwich.
Well, yeah. But
wafer thin things.
You have to have 9 slices of bacon. Yeah. Well, you eat old pack.
Eat old pack, yeah.
Well, you do, don't you? Yeah. I can eat, I'll smash old pack of bacon.
No problem.
No. Yeah. Whereas 2 slices of bacon, when it's nice and thick cured and doesn't leach water everywhere, for me was a real game changer.
Okay.
And it's still not cheaper than the cheapest bacon in Tesco's, which is where we shop.
Yeah.
But as, you know, we were discussing it and whether it would be something we would do every week going forward. And it's whether you want to have that as a prime product.
Yeah.
Is it
important? That's your premium product. Is it important enough to you to do
And that? I'll be honest, we probably won't do it all the time.
No.
But I might do it once a month.
So if I had access to a slicing machine, I might do it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Because I could see that even if I made it, sliced it, froze it.
Well, I'll throw some of mine.
Yeah. And then get 8 rashers out every week.
Yeah.
That's your Sunday breakfast or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're that's
well, I froze one pack. We ate the first one and then I kept the other one in the fridge. And I suspect that the one I cut would have been all right in the fridge.
Yeah.
But I was aware that, you know, bacon should be very heavily salted in order to store it.
Mm.
But again, the fridge isn't really the best place to keep it.
No. That's the problem I have with the cheese. It's going in the wine cooler. But it's still really damp in there. And it's just.
But beautiful flavour, and so much so, these are those little moments, is that, you know, Saturday morning, cook that bacon for the first time, make a sandwich to the kids, and Joe said, this isn't a normal bacon.
Yeah.
What is this bacon? Yeah. Where's this from? It's delicious.
Yeah.
And he didn't know I'd made it and all that.
Right.
And so it is worth doing it, isn't it? You know? So... and it's those little moments that you want, isn't it? That it does make a difference. Mm. And so I was really pleased that he and my daughter, who both like bacon sandwich on a Saturday, they noticed that it was different and tasty. And so I will be doing it for Christmas.
Yeah.
I want to get a bit of belly to do my pigs in blankets, you see.
Yeah, nice.
Thought that'd be a nice thing to
nice
do.
Touch, yeah.
And some nice bacon for the Sunday morning and things like that. So I think that maybe once a month, because you know, spending that much money on bacon is quite a lot.
Well, the thing is, if you did 36 rashers and you portioned them up as 8 rashers each, so 2 rashers per person, once a weekend, that's your bacon for the month for a tenner.
Yeah.
And a bit of effort.
Yeah, yeah.
When you think about it like that, actually.
Yeah,
it's
I mean,
bad.
It's
and you're getting the best quality bacon.
Yeah, I think you're paying a little bit for the sugar and salt, but not loads. But my next thing now is to do the same recipe and get the same result.
Yeah.
All right? And if I can do that, I will smoke it next.
Okay.
That's the next thing.
Well, so, that sounds like fun to me.
And that was a shop, Tesco, Sainsbury's bought piece of loin.
Yeah.
Boneless loin.
Yeah.
So I would say that Tesco's probably cheaper than Sainsbury's for meat.
I think so.
So I reckon I might be able to get that for around £8.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit less if I looked around. But a lot of supermarkets now are not carrying, I found, pork joints, because it's not very popular. So
funny, isn't it?
Well, you can't buy that meat in Asda and some places. Might be interesting to see how much is down at Morrison's, because I rate that butcher in there.
Well, Morrison's butcher's really good.
Yeah, but it's not that expensive, is it?
My local one. The thing is, the fella in there, it's the same fella who's been in there for ages.
Yeah.
He knows his stuff.
So if you went in there and asked him, when are you getting your pork in, because I want to make some bacon.
Yep.
I wonder how much he would charge you for a piece of belly or a piece of loin, because I know it'll be cheaper than the butcher's, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I've kind of got to that where I don't feel like I'm getting a better enough quality of meat from the butcher's to not go to the supermarket and use the supermarket meat. That's kind of where I'm at with that at the minute.
Well, I think a lot of people are having to make some tough decisions.
Yeah.
I would love to still be going to Tottenworth, where I know it's butchered on site.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the moment, I can't afford it.
Yeah.
And I know that there are many people out there listening to this in the same boat.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of your principles, I'm not saying that your principles have to go. As long as you can buy the best that you can with what you've got.
Yeah.
I can't justify spending £9 on a piece of bacon every week. I can't.
And I'm back into now, my weekly shop's gone up probably by 30%.
Mine's gone down.
Well, yeah, yours will have done. But mine, because I'm now not producing that many vegetables. Like in the summer, I was bringing those basketfuls of vegetables.
Right,
I was making a dent, right? But now it's gone back up to where it was, plus 30%, I would say. And certainly some of the meat that we buy, because we tend to buy the, you know, the higher welfare meat, has really rocketed in price.
Oh, I bet it has. And it's only going to go up. So,
so
the things that I'm noticing are the dairy product.
Yeah.
And that's the next. So, you know, I feel like we've done really well with the vegetables. Mm. The fruit needs a bit more management next year, without a shadow of a doubt. I feel like with the meat that I'm able to source myself and through association of, you know, someone who works for the council, like the venison I'm able to use and the duck and stuff like that and the pheasant. The meat isn't actually an issue at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, we don't buy any meat except bacon and sausages. That's it. That's all we buy. Don't buy anything else at all. You know, venison, we're eating a lot of venison, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But we're also eating a lot of eggs, because that's what I've got, which are free.
Yeah. That's the other thing, isn't it? It's back to that kind of thing we were talking about in the lockdowns. You know, you cook with what you got.
Absolutely.
Rather than going and buying stuff to make a recipe.
Absolutely. And I've moved my chicken house from down in the pasture up to the top, where they're now, they're so dry, happy, they're so much happier where they are. So I'm really pleased about that.
I'm going to have to do something with mine, because they've got where it's gotten so wet, it's just sodden in there.
Yeah, it's not
they're
nice,
dirty,
is it?
The eggs are coming out dirty.
Oh, it's horrible.
I'm going to have to pick up another bale of straw and some wood shavings, I think, and just give it a bit of a clean out. And then
we'll get them on Friday then.
Yeah.
You can just get them from in there, walking them, get them off the yard, so it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And if you're happy to do it yourself, in the yard where the straw is, if you sweep it off the floor,
they
can have nothing.
Oh, right,
so,
okay.
They'll let you do that, because you're doing them a favour.
Right.
So that's in the straw yard, in the barn.
Right.
So where they move bales around all the time,
it's all over
the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing else there. It's a perfectly clean floor.
Yeah.
It's been swept every day.
Yeah.
Just as long as you're happy to sweep it up and put it in the drag sack, you can have as much as you want, mate.
Right.
That's all I use for my chickens.
Okay.
So that's free.
Yeah. Free.
It's only a £5, but it's 5 quid you could spend on something else.
Fine.
Yeah. I was going to say something for the family out. Some of your vegetables.
That's
you're ridiculous. Like a pint.
That's a pint.
Pint.
It's not even quite a pint anymore. Anyway, we've got some questions to go through today, so I think we'll just take a break there, mate, if that's all right.
We'll come
back and we'll have a look at these little questions we've got here. Okay, mate, we're back. So before I came out tonight, I just put a shout out on the Facebook group. There's been quite a bit of activity on there just the last few days, and I just thought I'd just put it out there and see what people want to hear us talk about. So I've got some questions. And I'll just sort of run through them, really. And so as of about, I don't know, 40 minutes ago, when we started recording, I just checked in what was on there, and we've got a message from one David Rofe.
Oh, that's my brother.
Yeah. Want us to talk about garlic, but that's also seconded by Donna Moran. And Sean as well has come in and just asked us to talk a bit about garlic. So do you want to...
I love garlic.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I can't
my problem with garlic is not being able to grow enough, right?
Yep.
That is my big problem. So, where do you want to start? Now's the time to plant garlic, right?
Start with that.
So in where we live now, it's now is the time to plant garlic. But there's no rush, right? You've got until February, probably.
Yeah.
But the earlier you plant it, I would say, the bigger you'll get.
Most people would have planted it by now, I would say.
October is the first month.
I think you can do it late September, but October is the main time you do it.
Yeah.
And that's with a view then to getting the biggest bulbs you can produce next summer.
Yeah.
And possibly slightly earlier as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't completely understand the biological kind of process that's going on, but what you need for your garlic in order to... for it to produce a really good bulb, and it also really affects the storage quality of it, is this process called vernalisation, right? And vernalisation is going through a period of real cold before it then will sprout and start to grow. And I think that basically what you're trying to do is get those individual cloves set and settled in, right?
Well, you're trying to get some root growth on them before the winter comes.
A little bit. And I know that I planted my garlic this year in the spring because that's all I had.
Yeah.
And all it meant was that when I came to plant some of my cloves from the bulb, a lot of them had already rotted.
Yeah.
And so you don't get a very good return on your money if you're buying seed garlic, which leads me to probably the first thing is about your seed garlic, the source of where you're getting your seeds from. Because all you do when you're planting garlic is you have a whole bulb and you break it apart into individual cloves. And the only thing I would say is that just try and be a bit careful of the basal plate. That's that flat bit at the bottom.
The bit you cut off if you're going to go and...
That's the bit where the roots are going to grow out for. Yeah. So even if you push that into hard soil, you can damage that basal plate. Yeah. And what you're also going to do is when you break it apart, you're going to remove some sections of that, as you know, right? So where you get your seed from is important, but I have to say, I think that some of that is because seed companies don't want you to just take it from, you know, store-bought or shop-bought. And you do need to be careful, because if you go to Sainsbury's or Tesco's or your local shop and you buy garlic and try and plant it and grow it, it might be a variety which is used to much warmer temperatures.
Yeah, it's going to grow in Spain, isn't it?
Morocco or anywhere, it could be from anywhere.
Yeah.
But I think some of that you can take with a little bit of a pinch of salt. I think it'll all grow, and I think you will get a return. But it might be that you might need a really good summer, or you might need to put up with some slightly smaller cloves and things like that. Which doesn't matter if you plant enough, does it? I suppose.
No, plant more than you need.
And what I would say is that, and I won't dress it up. It's really, really expensive.
Buying garlic seed, even from my King's one.
It's about £7 for one bulb, for two bulbs.
Yeah.
And for two bulbs, you're going to get...
maybe 14, 18,
somewhere
in that region.
So then if you look at how much garlic is to buy, it suddenly is not that cheap, right?
No.
Until you can save your own seed.
Yes.
And that's where I think that you can start to save money and have a better product.
Yeah.
The alternative is to... buy your garlic from a supermarket or a source where you know it's come from.
Mm-hmm.
So if it says, it's from France, I might actually have a punt on that.
Yeah.
You know? And you might even get some British-grown garlic, but don't buy it as seed garlic, buy it as garlic.
Supermarket, supermarket.
Yeah, if you go and you can find us, then I would definitely have a go at that.
Go in the supermarket, you can buy 4 bulbs of garlic for about £1, can't you?
Absolutely.
And if they're grown locally, then all of a sudden you've got maybe, I don't know, you're looking at perhaps 50, 60.
Yeah, but it'll only cost you £2 or £3 probably, yeah. And I, you know, I've been caught out on that because if you're someone like me and you might, you know, might, I know you use way more than me, but I might use a bulb, a whole bulb in a fortnight, whereas I know you use that in one dinner probably.
Every Sunday, yeah, it's a whole bulb, just in roast dinner, yeah.
So we probably use a bulb a fortnight, maybe a bulb a week, but a bulb a fortnight. But I don't need 50 bulbs a week, a year. No. You know, probably about 30, 35. So
I probably need 100, I should think.
Yeah, but I know that other families who I work with alongside, they need about 150.
Yeah.
They use 2 or 3 a week, right? And so suddenly you have to work out how many you need, yeah? And then if you're looking to grow garlic for subsistence or for self-sufficiency, you need to have a variety of different garlics.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different types. So I would strongly encourage you to have a real close look at the different types of garlic you can buy.
Yep.
And the two main types that you'll see are hard neck and soft neck, yeah? I've always grown soft neck garlic because it keeps better,
yep.
But they're not as big.
Yeah.
Nowhere near as big. And what I'm gradually going over to is a bit of both, and then use obviously the hard neck first and then the soft neck afterwards. All right.
So I tend to grow soft neck because I want to store it.
Yeah.
But what I've found and what I've learned about myself is that I have not got the patience to stand and peel
millions of tiny garlic cloves. Yeah.
And so I'm probably either going to just go over to doing hard neck or not doing it at all.
Okay.
Because for me, I've got better things to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the garlic, the difference in quality from the garlic that you, the taste of it, is not that big. The one difference is when you get that fresh, new season garlic.
Green garlic,
Wet. It's still wet. And that is...
So the difference between the hard and the soft neck is that the hard neck garlic will put up a what is called a scape or quite a big flower stalk. That'll be noticeable when you open it. There's like a hard central neck. There's no other way to put it, is there?
Like most of the ones you buy in the shop.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is hard neck actually.
Yeah, a lot of it is.
And much easier to peel. I don't think there's a lot of difference in the flavours, if I'm honest with you. But if you can find a variety, and if you look in your seed catalogue, there will be different ones. I like Solent White. That's the one that I grow the most. And I grow Picardy, which is a French garlic. Right? They're the two that I grow mostly. Yeah. But I'll try anything, you know. But I have to say that I'm at a stage where for me to grow 50 cloves, it's going to cost me probably... £30 or £40 to buy the seed.
Yeah.
Am I better just to
buy the garlic?
Buy the garlic for that, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm thinking. So that's why I think that if you can get into self-saving your seed and then developing your own strain, which is used to the conditions that you're growing in year on year, then I could see that it could become self-sufficient.
Mate, you're inspiring me to have a go at this.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, but let's not just talk about that. You need to also look at elephant garlic, right? Which isn't really garlic.
No.
It's like leek, but they're bloody massive and they're lovely, right? So get some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely won't eat 50 of those a week, but do that. Yeah? But also, we feel that flavour with Ramsons, which is wild garlic,
yeah?
And Jack in the Hedge, which is two forage. Two forage crops, yeah, which do the same job. That's what I'll do. So, anyway, they're your varieties, where they come from.
Yep.
If you live somewhere wet, do not rush to put them in the ground.
Well, I was just going to say, I wouldn't be sowing garlic now.
Well, I would, but I might put it in a pot.
In a pot?
I might module it.
Raised bed, maybe.
Oh, definitely put it in a raised bed.
But if you're going to go and put it into clay soil now, with the amount of rain we've had, it's just going to rot out before it gets a chance to grow.
So... you can put it in any well-draining soil. You can definitely put it in containers. Garlic loves a container. Yep. But if you're like me and you've only got waterlogged soil or indoors, which is all full up at the moment, I'm actually going to raise individual cloves in individual pots.
Yep.
And I'll probably end up having 300 somewhere.
Yeah, but then you get them up to 6 inches.
And then I'll plant them all out.
Space in the garden, plant them out,
And they want to be... When you put them into the soil, they want to be obviously with the base plate down, so the little pointy bit sticking up just below the surface. And I mean just below the surface.
So the little pointy bit at the top where the kind of papery stuff comes up.
You don't want to be able to see it though. And there's a reason for that. So if you can get that just below the surface, that would be great. And then obviously, like you said, not too wet.
Yeah.
And they don't need watering or anything like that. Right? They're just going to sit in there. And the reason you don't want those little tips showing is because the one thing that they do suffer from is bird damage over the next couple of months. They just pull them up. They don't actually eat them half the time. So anything like crows and wood pigeons, they'll just come along and pull them up. A lot of people cover theirs with horticultural fleece.
Yep.
Right? And you're looking at about a foot apart between the rows and about 6 inches between plants. The further you have them apart, the bigger they will be. Yeah. There's no other way of putting it. If you put them much closer than 6 inches, I think you would start to notice a drop off in size.
Yeah.
That's the planting side. I don't think we need to talk really about lifting and raising. We could talk about that another day.
And if you
can find some decent cloves of garlic, which you know will grow in your area, I would get them. I would definitely get them. I do think it's a good crop to grow. I really do think it's a good crop to grow. I don't think there's much more to say about planting garlic than that.
Let's move on to our next question. We've got a question from Mark Johnson. He wants to know, hello Mark, you all right mate? He wants to know about what to be doing now in the winter months, because I know Mark, really good friend.
Planting garlic.
And I know that he's moved into a new house this year and he's just starting getting going. He's got a little vegetable patch, he's got a little greenhouse. He's grown some really lovely crops this year. He's put some pictures of those in the Facebook group and he's like, well, what should I be doing now? And I know that a bit like when we all started out, he's grown a load of stuff at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I think didn't have much space, so I don't think there was much that went in for the winter. I know he's got some purple sprout broccoli going on. I'm not sure there's much now going in. So he's kind of saying, what should I be doing now? And for me, it's kind of like, well, yeah, you could be doing your garlic. Is it too late to do broad beans?
No. I'd say it's a bit early.
A bit early to do broad beans.
So
maybe.
So your broad beans I would put in November.
Yeah.
So now.
Yeah.
But it is very important that you get the right variety.
Yeah.
And I would be looking at Claudia Aquadolce. That's the name of the variety that I know.
Yeah.
And there's another one called the Sutton, which is a dwarf broad bean. And they're overwintering beans. Mm. It will say on the back of the packet.
Yeah. Yeah.
They will grow. They will germinate and grow. They look really scraggy and patchy when they first come up. But certainly if you just leave them, they will tiller, so you'll get more than one that will come out from each thing.
Yeah.
But again, they will get eaten, though, if they get dug up. And mice love them.
Yeah.
So they will need probably some protection once you put them in.
Yeah.
So you could sow your broad beans now. You could definitely do that now. If, I don't know if you could get hold of any, but if I was keen to have something fresh in the garden, I would consider getting some shop-bought, they call it living greens, don't they? It's lettuce.
Yeah.
Right? Because lettuce is really hardy.
So.
And I would consider growing that under a cloche, even outdoors in a raised bed.
So get down your local garden centre, go and see what they've got in terms of...
I'd go to the supermarket first. Yeah, I would,
they've got the growing ones in.
Yeah. If you get something from the supermarket, though, you will have to harden it off.
Yeah.
But at the moment, that's not a problem, because it's so bloody warm.
Don't worry about it, yeah.
And at the same time, you could get some coriander and you could put that in the ground because it's rock hard.
Yeah,
What you won't get now is it's too late to sow it.
Yeah,
and it won't germinate.
But
and
if you've got plants, you can put them outside. You could definitely they grow.
They will.
Grow
happy. Yeah. They won't. You won't get loads of growth, but you'll get maybe a picking, four or five pickings of salad.
Yeah.
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 I don't think you're going to get much more than that now.
No. Well, I would be looking at not growing. And I'll be looking at the fact that in about 8 weeks' time, maybe 10 weeks' time, you could start thinking about sowing tomatoes again.
Yeah, yeah.
And chilies. And so I'd be looking then at getting everything prepped. So I'd be cleaning out all my pots. I'd be making sure everything that I've got is in decent nick.
Yeah.
You might consider sterilising or washing it. I don't bother, but a lot of people do. You certainly want to be cleaning out your greenhouse and sterilising the inside of that for mould spores and things like that. So giving that a good wash out, give it a good clean out for any algae and anything. Like
it's died, bruv.
Huh?
It's died.
Your one's died, is it?
The plastic powerhouse.
Oh, mate. R.I.P. plastic powerhouse.
The framework's all right. It's going to be Trigger's broom, isn't it? I've got to just get another bit of
plastic. Yeah.
Gaffer tape on, bad boy over the top of that.
Right. be all right. Get some plastic. Yeah,
a lot of money now, those plastic greenhouses. Yeah. I might try and build one now. I think
I'm sure you can fix it. It's about time you built one.
Either that, or I'm going to wait till a 6x4 free comes up on Facebook Marketplace. I'll go and take one apart and build it up. I think it's time anyway.
So clean that out, preparing the soil, mulching, like a big old thick layer of mulch.
Yeah, you've been composting a bit as well, haven't you?
I've been doing a load of composting. A lot of it's not ready yet.
Leaf mould making, though.
Making leaf mould would be really worthwhile. So that's just a question we spoke about before, but it's just getting some like bin bags, filling them up with wet leaves, poking a few holes in it and leaving it somewhere damp. I'm waiting for a bit. Yeah. That's it. That's your job, yeah? So seal it up, leave it somewhere damp, wait for about a year, I think it is, and then you've got your leaf mould for next year.
So you could definitely be doing that.
But getting some well-rotted manure in, getting some compost in, just lay it on the surface, if nothing else. What it will do is stop the weeds coming up, if nothing else. Mm. And the worms over the winter and the frost will break it all down into the soil, and you'll be laughing in the spring. That's worth doing.
And maybe if you've got more time on your hands, because you're not out in the allotment or garden tending to crops or weeding, you might actually be better off spending that time doing some work at a stables for free compost or muck.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you said, look, can I come and dig my own, or can I come and help you out for a morning and then take 10 bags of cotton? That's actually quite a good use of your time for quite a good return, isn't it? You know, for something that will pay you back many times over in the growing season.
The other thing I'll be thinking about is coming indoors. Get in your kitchen.
You could still grow on your windowsills inside.
Yeah.
You could be doing your cuttings and all that.
In there. I've got some ginger on the go in there. So those sorts of things. But I'm thinking like, it's a really good time to make a slow gin.
Mm.
Right? So you get out and get your slows. Get them in the freezer because they like to be frozen first, but then make some slow gin. The rose hips are ready. So get out there, go and gather some rose hips. Make some rose hip syrup. And then that makes fantastic wine.
Mm.
Once you've made the syrup, so make some syrup.
Hang on, mate. Let's go back a little bit. Let's just go back about granola, labna, rose hip syrup.
Now that'd go, wouldn't it? But then the other thing is you can start experimenting with other things. So it's this time of year that I start looking towards Christmas presents, making gifts for people. So it might be making some soap. It might be, I don't know, making some balms.
Carving, man. Making things out of timber.
It might be getting hold of some beeswax and making some beeswax wraps. Mm. So many, I mean, the beautiful thing about this as a lifestyle, there's so many different facets to it. It's just finding the bits that float your boat and thinking about what is
and
for you.
And it might also be a time if you've got a bed, like I know Mark's got an outside bed, right? And he could spend some time maybe making some cloches for that bed. Because he doesn't need them now, but when you need them, you tend to have a million other things to do, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
So, you know, doing a bit of work on some of the sort of hard landscaping and making some of those water pipe frame beds, or just getting some 2x1, or if you see some old roofing battens in a skip or something like that, or some old windows and making some cold frames or some cloches, that sort of thing now would actually pay you dividend in the spring, because you'll be able to put things in your beds way earlier if you've got cold frames over them, wouldn't you? And if you could make ones that would lift off, I think I've seen the beds that Mark made.
He's put a picture on the
Facebook if he group, could lift them off,
then
he could sew up his things probably a full month earlier, maybe even a bit earlier than that.
Yeah.
But and then he could just lift them on and take them off when as and when. That would be something else I'd be doing.
But the other thing is that it's a really good time just to be tidying up the garden. So getting around the garden, clearing out all the weeds, doing a bit of pruning. You know, it's not a bad time to be going and doing your it's a bit early really, but you could do your winter pruning now, hedges and things like that. Get that all shredded up, get that in the composter. Mm. That's a really good use of your time. In fact, I'd probably say it's the best use of your time this time of year. Because of the return that you get off of that is the bedrock of everything we do, compost, a good soil, compost. Absolute bedrock of it. So,
and the other thing that you could do now, which is there's still a tiny bit early because a lot of them are still in leaf, is that you could cut your pea sticks now for next year and bundle them up from any birch. But if you're someone who's got an open fire or wood burner, this November, December, January, I'd be getting my timber ready for next year.
Well, I've been going around collecting the birch twigs that have come down in these winds we've had lately.
Yeah.
And then just putting them somewhere dry. And I'm now using them for firelights. They're amazing firelights.
That smell, unbelievable. Man,
unbelievable.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. So, we had a question from Jane Vincent. She was asking about harvesting techniques to improve yields. And also about some ideas for ginger bugs.
Well, you do the ginger bugs.
Well, let's do the harvesting techniques. And to be fair, she mentioned two of the ones that we most likely come out with, which is things like kale, you know, harvesting those outer leaves and letting the centre bit grow up and leave that be. And
there's many crops
and the same
like
with basil.
So many crops like that. So it is amazing how, because we buy it like it, we think a lettuce has to be a whole lettuce.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm cropping lettuce, pak choi, kale, certainly chard, cabbages almost,
yeah.
You know, all I'm doing is cut and come again.
Yeah.
And I would encourage you to do that, and you will get, it'll go on for months and months and months if you do them like that. And you'll end up with like a long stalk of a lettuce with a little bit on the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it will have given you tenfold the amount that you've got if you just cut the whole head off. So I would really, really encourage you to do that. And I think that now as well, and I've noticed this in the tunnel, is that if you've got a quite closely planted row, I can see the benefit of taking intercropping out every other one because you will get some dampening off otherwise. Yeah, sure. So if you've got chard in particular, maybe just, you know, take the ones out to have really good airflow going through.
So
those,
that's almost over sowing and then using the thinnings to take them out and eat them. Yeah.
Yeah, or just have loads of rows. Like I've got. Yeah.
But I've certainly done that with like the cut and come again seed packets that you get.
Yeah.
Where you for best
oversow
world,
it, yeah.
Best one in the world, you sprinkle it down a row, you're going to oversow it, yeah.
Yeah.
And so at that point, then you start to just thin out as they start to get a reasonable size, thin out the odd ones and then leave the others to grow like you describe. And then you get a really good crop with that.
And I would also say, you know, there is sometimes a tendency at this time of the year to kind of, you get in that position of, well, shall I let those things go a bit more or shall I get them in and get them cleared and stuff like that. And I suppose it's just making use of everything that you can. So like going back to the cauliflower, we're getting two harvests off one crop, really.
Do the same with the chard by eating the stalks.
I'm clearing tomatoes now, but there's a lot of tomatoes on there. It would be much easier just to dig them all up and put them in the trailer and put them on the compost heap. But if you just spend that time going through them, you're going to get that crop coming off that you want.
You're still eating fresh tomatoes into December. You will be.
I think. And like with the carrots that are in the wet, you know, I know I've got to get them out and some will be gone, but I will do something with that crop.
Yeah.
I'll either cook them and feed them to chickens or feed them to pigs.
Yep.
And the worst that'll happen is that I'll go on a compost.
I think the thing is about this is about understanding the biology of the plants that you're growing, yeah? Something about purple sprouting broccoli, where I've taken the head out now of a couple of the plants because they've got to a reasonable size.
Mm.
What I don't want is for that plant to start sending hormones back down into the base of the plant, which says, we've done our job here.
We've
produced a crop. You don't need to worry now. So it's about getting in there early enough, not letting things get too overripe so that the plant gets that hormone, that kind of, I forget what the name of it is, but it's the inhibiting hormone that stops it producing more fruit because it knows that it's done its job, yeah? But then also thinking about where you make your cuts.
Certainly on purple sprouting broccoli.
Purple sprouting broccoli, basil, those kinds of plants where you've got a stem. It's looking then for where those the nodes have grown from the sides and they've actually then produced new stems or leaf.
Mm.
And it's then looking about cutting back to where the next good bit's going to be. So it grows out from there. A bit like if you were pruning a tree, you cut it back to a good healthy point.
And it make two new ones.
And then you'll get the growth that comes out the side, which will be really, really nice and healthy. Whereas if you cut it in the middle of a stem, you get a bit of rot as well, for starters.
Yeah.
You can certainly get a better crop off a purple sprouting broccoli by cutting it in the right place.
Absolutely.
It's difficult to describe it in this medium, but perhaps...
No, I think it really does make sense. And I think a lot of that is... People will, you know, when you're looking at it, you can kind of see where that naturally would form.
Yeah.
So, but definitely do that kind of thing. But as far as ever harvesting goes, don't forget that wild harvest. So it's sweet chestnut time in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've already picked and frozen my sweet chestnuts for winter.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you go out on a walk, you'll certainly be able to find some chestnut trees and you can certainly be harvesting from those. There are good mushrooms out there at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit wet at the moment.
Brussels sprouts, don't be tempted to cut the whole stem.
No, definitely not.
You know, and actually to be prepared to take all the leaf off down the sides, take the Brussels out that are ready to go, and then leave the smaller ones to grow, they'll keep coming.
And even when you've eaten all the sprouts.
Eat the sprout tops.
Oh.
They're the best bit, I think.
Oh, man. Absolutely. Something else that I learned, though, is that one of my colleagues is actually married to a lady from Thailand, and she was talking to me, he was talking to me about how on broccoli, on sprouts, I would eat the whole stem.
Oh, really?
Mandolin, the whole stem.
Yeah.
And use that as another vegetable.
Even the woody bits of it?
Absolutely.
Wow.
We don't do any of that.
No, I wouldn't even consider it.
And absolutely delicious.
All right.
Mandolin, thinly sliced, like a water chestnut.
I'm going to have to try this.
It's got to be done, like, isn't it? Yeah. You're getting your two crops from one there, you know, which is
same,
I like.
Again, with your beetroot, don't just eat the root, eat the leaf.
You can't eat the leaf. Mind you, some of them are looking pretty jaded now.
Well, but you're looking for the nice small leaf, aren't you? Not looking for the massive ones that come out of it, but the small leaf is really good.
And now, going into the spring, I think chard is just that crop, which just literally get two crops from one. It's such a good crop, isn't it? So I would say all of those things are things that you could learn some different harvesting techniques on. And I also would be making sure that even if I hadn't sown them myself, I know I can go and buy chervil, coriander, some parsley, and they will give you a harvest if you plant them even now. They will continue to grow in the ground. And they are a game changer if you're someone who wants some fresh herb flavour. You know, having a curry in the middle of winter is a beautiful thing, but having a curry and then going out and cutting some of your own coriander and having that on the top, that takes it to a different place, doesn't it?
And don't forget, you know, I've got beans still standing.
No, I haven't.
I haven't been up there. I haven't had time to take them down. So the beans still standing. Don't forget those last beans. If you dry them and shell them, you can eat those. You have to soak them and cook them really well first, but you can eat those.
Or you keep them for your seed.
Or you keep them for your seed for next year, or both if you've got enough. You know?
Yeah, so, I've got one row that I can't get in the field.
Yeah,
that's my trouble.
Yeah.
So there's lots of harvests to be had.
Yeah.
But it's also now the hunt. If you're someone who eats meat, the hunt season for pheasant is open now. Mm-hmm. So you might have the opportunity to try some pheasant. It tends to be a bit more expensive this side of the new year.
Yeah.
It gets cheaper as people have filled up their freezers and things like that. But if you get the opportunity to try some, eat some, I would definitely advocate that. You will definitely do you some because you haven't had any for ages and you got put off it when you were young. And I can understand why. So we get you a nice, fresh young and breast it out and you won't even know the difference, mate.
No, I look forward to that. I really look forward to that.
Great.
Okay, so the second bit then was ginger bugs. And the ginger bug is probably my bag, isn't it? And for me, that's kind of those citrusy flavours. So I'm looking at lemon, orange juice, maybe lime, ginger. Those kinds of flavours is what I would tend to put into my ginger bug, but that's absolutely no reason why you couldn't go and get your strawberry coolie that you've made or raspberry, whatever you've got in the freezer, and mix that into it and ferment that out. So the only real limit on the ginger bug is, you know, your taste and your ability to produce stuff. So you could do it with mint if you wanted to. You could do it with, I don't know, blueberries, whatever you've got, literally. Mix in a bit of that kind of syrup into something. Rosehip syrup.
Mate.
Get that in there, yeah?
That sounds great.
Let's go down the slow gin route. Stick some slow gin in it and make a cocktail out. You know, there's so many things you could do. So it's just then a question of finding those flavours. What ingredients have you got and making the most of those ingredients? Anna Tarpley asked about milking goats. And I've got to be honest, this is not an area of great expertise of mine.
Nor mine.
So
We'll ask Carl,
yeah.
Get back to you.
What I can say is that Carl's on a bit of a hiatus at the moment on the Self-Sufficient Hub, but he has got a massive back catalogue, nearly 500 episodes of various things, and he kept goats for some time. He hasn't got any at the minute, as far as I'm aware.
We'll put a pin in it, though, because it won't be long, mate.
And I'm still looking. I actually found a fella that knows about there's a bit of land up the back, and he works for the water company. And I was like, is that land belongs to the water company? I met him at the weekend at a party. He's like, I don't know, but I can find out. So next time I see him, I might see if he's found out for me, see if we can get that sorted. And then Sean's returned from a little internet-free, however long it's been, 2.5 months or something. And so welcome back. And she's mentioned garlic, but she's also asked about protecting strawberry plants. Now, bear in mind, she is in Sweden, which is a slightly different climate to here. And I'm going to say,
alpine strawberries, mate.
Protecting strawberry plants for me is a case of do nothing. Because they'll be absolutely fine here.
Yeah, they would be.
But I'm assuming you're talking about protecting from the cold. So I'm looking at horticultural fleece. I don't know if that'd be enough, though.
Well, you've got some different options. You could lift them and put them in a pot.
Yeah.
But then you're not going to, you know, they're always going to be trying to establish themselves, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think I'd be looking at covering them probably with a layer of straw.
Okay, yeah.
That's probably what I would try and do in that kind of position. It depends how big the patches that you've got as well.
Depends how cold it gets. I mean, I'm imagining minus 10 and below, right? So
I haven't a clue.
Having said that, I've had minus 10 temperatures where I live with strawberries in the ground and they've survived that perfectly well.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about strawberries is that over the winter, they'll look kind of dead.
Yes.
Let's be honest, won't
they?
They go brown.
Yeah.
They, you know, most of the foliage dies off, doesn't it? You might get one or two sort of...
Well, when it stays like this, they kind of...
Strandy little bits, yeah. But you know, again, they probably, you know, are a plant which can tolerate quite a low level of temperature anyway. Mm-hmm. If you were growing them, and we don't know what your conditions are, that, you know, there's a big difference between being in the ground and being in a raised bed, temperature-wise, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, and if they're in a raised bed, you might be all right. You know, mm-hmm. you might be able to just put a bit of horticultural fleece on them and they actually be okay. If they're in the ground, they might need something much more colder, considerable, duvet.
Well, straw is a duvet, isn't it, effectively? Yeah. Might have to find a way to peg it down so it's blown away.
Yeah, but, yeah. But what I did read, which was quite interesting, is that even very small things make a massive difference to the ground temperature. Mm. So even just by laying some loose branches over the soil, it makes a massive difference.
Right.
And then even if it snows, you've still got pockets of air there. Snow's actually quite a good insulator, though.
Yeah.
So that actually probably wouldn't be that bad. And I know my strawberry plants have survived under snow many years.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd be looking at maybe some different levels of insulation, but you would have to be very careful if you put that on, that didn't then inhibit the growth that you need in the spring.
Well, that's the nice thing about the straw idea that you came up with initially, is that they'll grow up through that, won't they?
I would definitely look to be exploring straw.
Yeah.
What I wouldn't want is a lot of damp rot off in that straw in and around the plant tops, you know what I mean? So I would give them a really good covering, but then I would be probably quite tempted that as soon as the temperature starts to raise, I might be having a little dig. I probably wouldn't want them to grow through that if it gets wet.
Would you be tempted to put straw and then a bit of like black plastic down or something like that?
Not over the top plastic, of the hole.
No.
I wouldn't, because I think that you're going to either end up getting really bad rot off, or they might actually dry out.
I suppose so. Yeah.
I think that the horticultural fleece over the top's not a bad shout. But some way of holding that straw in place, I think that's the route I would go.
Well, chicken wire's the obvious solution to that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just peg some chicken wire down around it and that'll solve that problem.
Yeah, I think that could work.
Well, I think straw will probably be sufficient, to be honest, unless you're talking about seriously negative temperatures, because like I said, we've had, you know, it was just, not very many nights, but a couple of nights we've got down to minus 10 where I am in the past, and the strawberry plants have been outside, have been absolutely fine.
Traditionally, they would have been in a cloche or a cold frame with lights.
So that's the other option, isn't it?
With lights that you can, on a nice day, you can open and get the ventilation right and then shut it back up. So, you know, when you think about those big old Victorian gardens in the UK, they would have had acres of, I think they're called Dutch lights that you can slide back and forth. Yeah. And so going back to what we were talking about with Mark, maybe spend some time making some cold frames, which you can open a little bit to ventilate.
Yep.
And I think that that's the most important thing. So
need some window handles, don't you, for that?
You could knock them up.
And then the next question was about immature fruit trees and bushes. And I think probably that really what we're talking about there is pruning, maybe. In terms of, again, of protecting them, that's just more about having the right varieties. You want ones that, you know, the fruits and things that you're going to be able to grow in your climate, making sure you've got the right fruit for the right climate. When they get big, you can't really mulch a tree and keep the frost off it. If you don't like the fruit being frozen, then you've had it.
If you've got fruit, for instance, I don't know what the setup is here, but you might have some fruit trees that are in pots.
Mm-hmm.
If you're growing in quite a cold climate, you might be able to move them inside.
Like lemons would need to be coming.
But you could have dwarf apples, dwarf cherries, dwarf pears. All of those could be grown in pots. So it depends, again, where these fruit trees are. What is important, though, for fruit trees is to have that period of dormancy. And I think that, for me, I would be making sure that I had some other things in place to give them the opportunity to get through. So if it was me and I had some fruit trees that I planted this year, what would I be looking to do to make sure that they got through the winter? Right? So I would be making sure the drainage in and around those trees was really good. What I don't want is a root ball to sit for weeks in water to, in effect, drown out. Right. Yeah. So make sure the drainage is good.
Yeah.
I'd be making sure my staking was really good.
Yeah.
So with very young trees like that, make sure that they're not going to get wind rocked, which then would damage the root ball and then lead you to have problems down the line.
What's really interesting about that is that I know I was taught a particular way to do it, and I don't think I ever see anywhere trees staked in that way. Which is, obviously, I was taught by a fellow who was about as knowledgeable as they come, when I did, RHS fellow that was doing the course I was doing. And yet what you see is these upright stakes next to trees quite often, sometimes a pair of them.
Yeah.
And his stake was really low to the ground.
Mm.
You'd struggle to get your foot underneath it.
Mm.
And it was just like just really holding the base of the tree down.
Yeah.
So I think it's about then having a really good look at different ways of doing it. Yeah, find the technique that works for you.
It depends on what the weather is where you are. You know, and if you've got a lot of top growth, you don't want it to break either, do you? That's the other thing. And what I am finding, though, is that more and more seasonally, the weather is hard to predict, isn't it? And so what you really don't want with any of these trees with regards to windrock is strong winds when it's in leaf.
Yeah.
That's obviously where it just becomes a giant sail, doesn't it? Yeah. So it's one of those that just have every stake you can at the beginning, mate. That's what I would suggest.
Well, the one that he did was at like a 45 degree angle, really low, right down at the base of the tree, really tied in, quite tight. Obviously, they're protected so it doesn't damage the bark on the outside.
And I've used pears at the moment, not pear trees,
pairs
of stakes, all singles, but I'm growing M27, so they're only going to get about 1.8 metres anyway, so they're not very high. And it does depend on what variety you're growing. The other thing that you could think about doing now, if you've got trees which are not that established and you might be worried about some pest damage over the winter, you could do some grease banding.
Yep.
That's something else which you could do on smaller trees where perhaps you might notice the pest pressure a bit more on them. If they're immature and you're not that worried about the fruit, but you want lots of vegetative growth as well, I don't think it's a bad idea to incorporate some wood ash from your fire in and around the root ball area. That's what I've been doing with mine.
Yep.
And that won't give you a lot of fruit, though. That might lead to next year to having a lot more vegetative growth. But in those first few years of your tree, you probably do want it.
Fruit in the first couple of years anyway.
No, so you want to maybe have a look at getting some good nitrogen down into the soil. Yeah. And wood ash is very good for that. So
whereas if you're doing fruit bushes, you think about things like black currants and that sort of thing that you're hoping are going to fruit next year, you do need to be pruning them.
Yeah.
And that is a question then of taking out about a third of the growth.
Yeah.
One stem in every three, cutting it right down to the base in most cases, certainly for black currants, red currants, that kind of thing. Down obviously then to a node where you're going to get a nice leaf growth coming out of it again.
Mm.
And you're particularly with black currants looking to take out the oldest growth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because what you're going to get is fruit on this year's wood. So this year's wood will produce fruit next year. So you're trying to keep that wood for next year and taking out the older stuff in favour of this year's
growth. I think, you know, looking at soft fruit, we could do that next time as well because we could talk about raspberries and fruit trees and pruning and all of that. But one other thing maybe the last thing we talk there is that winter is actually a really good time to mulch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's something that I've learned this year is that when I was looking at the soil and planting my trees and all my soft fruit, I thought it was going to stay the same, but I found it very hard to keep up with the weeding. And I know that part of my job this winter will be to lay weed suppressant matting all over my orchard, all over it, in and around all of the raspberries and the strawberries and the rhubarbs. And I will probably cut a metre and a half radius circles to go in and around all the fruit trees as well. And you could do that now.
Yeah.
Because nature's on your side. It will kill most of the weeds down.
Yeah.
It'll be at the lowest it'll ever get. Maybe if you get a dry day, give it a really as close as you can cut it to the ground. Or if you're feeling really, dig it over.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a nice enough day, I mean, there's no chance I'm doing that at the moment. No. But if you can get rid of that top bit of grass and growth and then put your weed suppressant matting down, you'll be a step ahead. So that's where I would go with that.
And going back on the pruning with the fruit bushes, you want to be waiting until the leaf's down to do that, really. You let them get the nutrients back in off the leaf before you start thinking about doing anything like that.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that's thank you so much for all those lovely people that have put comments on there and questions. I really appreciate that. Hopefully some of what we've had to say there is useful.
Hope so.
Otherwise, wasting our time and yours, eh?
It's past my bedtime now,
bro. It is, mate. So we're going to have to wrap it up there. But thank you so much for listening again to another episode of the Homesteading UK podcast. Really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed the interactions on the Facebook group recently. So if you are listening and you're not in there, please get yourself into that Facebook group.
Get your hounds on it.
It's a really good place.
Was it Homesteading Hounds?
Homestead Hounds, yeah. We're going to get on there. And it's just a really good place to get lots of positive feedback and people posting up things they've done. It's been really nice to see others coming in and saying, oh yeah, I really like that.
Damn right.
So, really good to see. So thank you very much for listening. Like I say, if you're not in there, get in there and please tell all your friends about us and we will speak to you again in a couple of weeks.
Toodle pip!
Bye-bye. So thanks very much everyone for listening through to the end of another episode of the Urban Homesteading UK podcast. If you've enjoyed what you're listening to, please come and join us on our Facebook group. You can come find us on Urban Homesteading UK on Facebook. Come and find us on Instagram and all those other good places. Please tell your friends about us and do come and listen again. Thank you. Bye-bye.